This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk with Ramona Africa, sole surviving adult of the MOVE bombing in 1985.
28 years later, we still look at it with shock and amazement. Bombing a house in the middle of Philadelphia? Killing 11? Burning down the neighborhood? What was this about?
Asada Shakur, who has political asylum and is living in Cuba, has now been placed on the FBI's most wanted terrorist list.
It wasn't enough that our government framed her, offered a reward for her capture. Now they want to turn her into a terrorist, at least according to their definitions.
Members of the Coalition of Immokalee Workers in Florida are in New York working on a new campaign here.
After 11 victories against major corporations, they bring their campaign to New York and around the country to try and force Wendy's to pay the penny a pound and sign the Fair Food Agreement.
Stay with us.
New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, President Emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Here at Law and Disorder, we've covered Guantanamo since its very beginning. The Center for Constitutional Rights and I were all lawyers in the earliest cases to try and close Guantanamo. We began the cases in 2002. We've gotten a lot of people out. But now we're at a stubborn point with Guantanamo. 166 people remain. 86 of those people have actually been cleared for release by our own government, or someone's government, the United States government. And yet it remains open with no foreseeable future for closing it. This is despite Obama's promise to close it, a promise that, of course, he has failed to meet. A few months ago, actually about 90 days ago, I would have said, it's done. We're not going to be able to do it. We've done everything we can legally. The press has ignored it. We have a few small groups out there, Witness Against Torture being the primary one in the orange jumpsuits that tries to keep the issue alive. But really, we did not see it having a shot at being closed in this next 4 years. Obama abolished the office that was going to close it. And then what happens in these remarkable situations is something astounding. The people most affected by the opening and the remaining open of Guantanamo, the oppressed themselves, took on the issue on their own, and they have gone on a hunger strike that is changing the way we look at Guantanamo and gives the first hope for maybe getting it closed. It's awful that it had to go to the point where the oppressed themselves had to decide that this is their struggle, these are their lives, and while we can keep filing lawsuits, and religious people can continue to yell about it, and politicians like Obama can continue to make promises, in the end, it's the oppressed themselves that are going to decide the fate of Guantanamo. Unfortunately, it's a very painful process. Over 100 people are now on the hunger strike. They're laying on cold concrete floors in solitary confinement in their cells, getting thinner and thinner and thinner. Every day, perhaps three times a day, 24 of those people are taken out of their cells, strapped into a chair, and in what one detainee described as the equivalent of a razor blade being stuffed down his nose and through his esophagus, he is force-fed, 24 of them, force-fed. That, of course, is illegal. We know that from the American Medical Association, moderate as it is, has said it's illegal to force feed the people at Guantanamo. People have a right to make those kind of decisions in their life. But there's already been a change. Would I say I'm optimistic? No. But I'm hopeful for the first time. Obama was forced to make a major speech saying he wanted it closed. But that speech is meaningless because Obama refused to take the actions that are necessary to close it, simply mouthed his usual BS, I have to work with Congress. In fact, Obama has the power on his own to close Guantanamo. Obama has the power today, tomorrow, and the next day to give waivers and get people out of there immediately. He's refused to do so. Since Congress imposed that restriction on Guantanamo, and it is onerous, Obama has not exercised one of the waivers. The fault lays at the feet of Obama. Each of you listening to this have to take action now. The detainees have done what they can. They're on a hunger strike. We now have to support them. Go and sign the various petitions. Get active. Go to the Center for Constitutional Rights website. Go to the Witness Against Torture website. Call your members of Congress. Don't let these prisoners down. They've taken the last action they have that they can take to try and close the place. The rest is up to us. Make Obama do what he promised.
Michael, I understand that you recently visited Julian Assange.
Yes, I spent a couple of days at the embassy in London, where Julian still is. We're coming up on the one-year anniversary in June. Julian is doing fine. Progress with Sweden to try and get a guarantee that he won't be shipped off to the United States. So far, Sweden has not been willing to do that. He's in that embassy because he knows if he goes to Sweden, it's a ticket to some underground prison for life in the United States. But the visit was good. He's in good spirits. As I'm sure our listeners know, recently WikiLeaks released 1.7 million cables that are now highly searchable. It's called the Kissinger documents, and they're fabulous to look through. Go on WikiLeaks, find them, put in anybody you might have known, and you'll come up with a bunch of names. So that's interesting. Julian was in good shape, and I brought a journalist with me. Chris Hedges came and spent some time with Julian interviewing him. And you can go to the website of TruthDig and read Chris's article, as well as some audio that Chris put up of his interview with Julian. The article is incredible. The article is called The Death of Truth. And it's really a fairly long article, comprehensive, about the efforts of the United States to prosecute Julian Assange, Bradley Manning, Jeremy Hammond, and other truth tellers, and what Chris calls the death of truth. And to Chris, not to that he necessarily said this, but I think he almost said these people are heroes, because Chris understands that what they're doing is not just about information and secrets and criminality, but they're taking on the essence of the empire. And to Chris, that's crucial. And I really recommend The Death of Truth by Chris Hedges on TruthDig and The Nation. I want to read just one little bit out of the article so you can get a sense. The world has been turned upside down. The pestilence of corporate totalitarianism is spreading rapidly over the earth. The criminals have seized power. It is not, in the end, simply Assange or Manning they want. It is all who dare to defy the official narrative to expose the big lie of the global corporate state. The persecution of Assange and Manning is the harbinger of what is to come, the rise of a bitter world where criminals in Brooks Brothers suits and gangsters in beribboned military uniforms, propped up by a vast internal and external security apparatus, a compliant press, and morally bankrupt political elite, monitor and crush those who dissent. Writers, artists, actors, journalists, scientists, intellectuals, and workers will be forced to obey or thrown into bondage. I fear for Julian Assange. I fear for Bradley Manning. I fear for us all. It's a very strong piece by Chris Hedges. Talks about empire in it.
What's the status of Julian's case?
Now, we think it's more likely than not that Julian Assange has been indicted in the United States. The grand jury has been relatively quiet for the last year or so. You know, there's some evidence that came out of the Stratfor emails that there was a sealed indictment. Our view is it's likely an indictment against Julian at this point.
Michael, what's the relationship between Assange's cases and Bradley Manning's coming trial?
I think that's a really important question. The Bradley Manning case is scheduled to go to trial June 3rd. There's pretrial hearings going on this week around some various issues, actually a big issue, which is how they're going to handle the secrecy at Bradley Manning's trial. And they're doing a mock day in which they're putting on a mock witness or something to see how it goes. Now, of course, secrecy in Bradley Manning's trial is ridiculous because they claim that 750,000 documents that you and I can read every day on the internet, those are secret and they can't be introduced in court. So all the evidence against Bradley Manning will be in a closed session that everybody has the documents to. So the whole thing is, you know, you can't make it up. But the relationship is, I think, as follows. They want to make an example out of Bradley Manning. He's pled guilty already to the equivalent of 20 years. They want to give him 140, whatever they want to give him. And whatever, and he'll be the template for Julian Assange. They will either try and break Bradley Manning, which they haven't been able to do in the belief that he has some evidence that can get Julian, or they just want to say, if we can get him for life, we have a much better chance of getting Julian Assange. And so that's what I think is going on. And I think after the Bradley Manning trial is over, we'll see what happens with Julian Assange and what they say. But it is outrageous because he's already pled guilty to 20 years.
Can we just go back for a second to the issue of a sealed indictment? How often are sealed indictments brought? Is that because it's so-called national security? What's the strategic reason for a sealed indictment?
Generally, when there's someone they don't have their hands on, they issue a sealed indictment because they don't want the person to be aware that there's an indictment against them. So I think it's not that uncommon to have a sealed indictment. It could happen even in the case of a U.S. kidnapping or something, and they go after somebody. For all you know, Heidi, you know, when you did that shoplifting the other day, there's a sealed indictment. You shouldn't have taken those bobby pins. So that's the situation. Still a crisis situation, in my view. Julian's still in the embassy. The article is terrific. Bradley's about to go to trial. And the U.S. continues its incredible crackdown on whistleblowers.
There's been some positive movement in the move to have Lynn Stewart released under the government's Compassionate Release Program. In late April, interestingly enough, the government issued a lengthy report criticizing the Compassionate Release Program as currently administered.
Yeah, it's 20 years old. You could put everybody they've released into a grade school classroom. The report itself said that prisoners are not notified of the possibility of their getting out, that many have died in prison even after they've applied for it. So it's a scandal. I think that pressure that all of you out there have put on the government by signing those petitions, and there's thousands of signatures in support of Lynn, have helped us. There was an editorial in the New York Times last week on it, and I think there's progress being made on getting Lynn out. So keep up the good work. We're going to put it on our website, lawanddisorder.org or lynnstewart.org. Go to that. Find out where you signed the petition. Keep the support up because it's working.
This week marks the 28th anniversary of an armed police mission in Philadelphia that ended in a helicopter bombing of the headquarters of the group known as MOVE. The fire commissioner in that city allowed a fire to rage unabated at 6221 Osage Avenue in West Philadelphia, killing 6 adults and 5 children, destroying 65 homes, and leaving over 200 people homeless. Despite 2 grand jury investigations and a commission finding that top officials were grossly negligent, no one from city government was ever criminally charged. A recent film called Let the Fire Burn chronicles the events leading up to the conflagration. Today we welcome Ramona Africa, the only adult survivor of the MOVE bombing. Ramona, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Thank you for having me and giving me the opportunity to address your listening audience.
To understand the atrocities of May 13th, we really need to go back 6 years to 1978 at the shootout of MOVE's first home. Can you summarize briefly what happened then and why the police attacked your family's home?
Okay. I'm glad you brought that up because the media, the government through the media, have misled people to believe that what happened in May of 1985 happened because of some complaints from neighbors, which is just absolutely not true. What happened on May 13th of 85 happened because of our unrelenting fight for the release of our innocent sisters and brothers known as the MOVE 9, who were arrested in August of 1978 under the regime of then Mayor Frank Rizzo. You know, after years of abuse, physical abuse, you know, judicial abuse by this system, MOVE babies being killed through miscarriage and the 3-week-old MOVE baby being trampled to death by police, after countless unprovoked beatings of MOVE men, women, children, even pregnant women, MOVE people took a stand and said, listen, we are uncompromisingly opposed to violence. We're a peaceful people, but we're not stupid and we're not masochistic or suicidal. We do believe in self-defense, which is the law of life. there is not a species on this earth that does not defend itself when threatened, when attacked. That is the law. So when MOVE took that stand, the government really became enraged because, of course, you're never supposed to take a stand against the government. So what happened was they alleged housing code violations and wanted MOVE to move out of our home based on alleged housing code violations. I mean, things like no screens in the windows. And MOVE people would not go along with that. A judge had given MOVE till August 1st to get out, and some MOVE people were sent on other activities. A couple of our sisters went to Richmond, Virginia. Some of our people ended up in Rochester, New York. And to really crystallize how this was not about any housing code violations, on August 2nd, Judge G. Fred DeBona issued warrants for every MOVE person that he thought he knew of, including people that he knew were not in the house, you know, people that were in Richmond, Virginia, and Rochester, New York. So after these warrants were issued on August 8th of 1978, I mean, hundreds and hundreds of cops were sent out to our home allegedly to pick up MOVE people, arrest MOVE people, to show cause why they should not be held in contempt for still being at MOVE headquarters. But understand, some of the people listed in those warrants were not even in the house, and they knew it. So that's how August 8th happened. The cops came out there not to arrest or to bring to court, but to kill. They shot thousands of bullets into that house. The fire department used their deluge hoses to flood our home. It was horrible.
At the attack of your first house, a police officer was killed.
Yes.
That formed the basis for why the so-called MOVE 9 are doing life in prison.
That's the excuse used by the government, because the officer that was killed was standing on street level while everybody, including the police, acknowledged that all MOVE people were in the basement of our home. And this police officer was shot with the bullet traveling on a downward angle, making it physically impossible for any MOVE person to have shot him. And they know it, which leads to why, within hours after my family was arrested on August 8th, the city sent a demolition team out and completely demolished MOVE's home, which was the scene of the crime. They deliberately destroyed evidence. They didn't care. And finally, this trial of my family, known as the MOVE 9, was a bench trial by Judge Edwin Malmit. It was not a jury trial. And after convicting 9 of my family members of third-degree murder and conspiracy and several counts of assault, and sentencing each of my 9 family members to 30 to 100 years each, Judge Malmit went on a radio talk show here in Philadelphia, and Mumia Abu-Jamal heard him, so he called in, and he asked Judge Malmit one simple question: who killed Officer Ramp? Judge Malmit replied, "I haven't the faintest idea." Now, this is after he convicted and sentenced 9 of my family members to 30 to 100 years in prison.
We know that the Philadelphia judicial system and police system is among the most corrupt in this country.
The only one to be indicted by the Department of Justice, the entire Philadelphia Police Department.
The startling occurrences that all of us remember, in addition to what you've just described, is when the police in Philadelphia burned down the entire block. Could you talk to us about what they did there and why they did that?
Sure. they did it in an attempt, a failed attempt, to silence our righteous protest and our unrelenting fight for the release of our family, the Move 9. What they did was they came out to our home on Mother's Day, May 12th of 1985, with warrants that they obtained on Saturday, May 11th, from Judge Lynn Abraham, who later became the District Attorney of Philadelphia. And they went with her, went to her with an issue that was really a non-issue that had happened 2 weeks later, when cops were all around the back of our home and we turned on our microphone and let people know that they were back there and that we didn't trust them. We didn't know what they were up to. After we turned the microphone off, which was like maybe 20 minutes to a half an hour at the most, several cops came up to our home, walked right up the steps, knocked on the door, and myself and my sister Teresa Africa, who was killed in the bombing, we came out and we talked to these cops for like an hour at least. When we finished and they were satisfied, they walked away. But they used that situation to go to Lynn Abraham, Judge Lynn Abraham, on Saturday, May 11th, to get warrants for us alleging disorderly conduct, terroristic threats. I think those were the two main charges. And that is what they used to come out there with on May 12th.
They started with four deluge hoses and they sprayed the house with water.
Yeah, the fire department, again, as in 78, was their first mode of attack. They have four deluge hoses, which they claim pump out 10,000 pounds of water pressure per minute. So you're talking about four hoses, so you're talking about 40,000 pounds of water pressure per minute. And they did this for hours. After they did that, the police, they drilled or exploded holes in the party walls on both sides of our house, because these are row houses. They're all connected. These are row houses that we lived in on Osage Avenue.
And they'd actually evicted the neighbors so that they were all out of their homes.
Yes, they did. They told the neighbors to go out to dinner, take their mothers out to dinner, because remember, this is Mother's Day, and that they would, you know, be able to come back that night. You know, everything would be over, et cetera. They moved cars off the street, and they set up all day long. They were out there setting up their weaponry of war. They had their sidearms, what are they, 38s, I think, that, or 357s, whatever the cop sidearms are. They had M16s, sniper rifles with silencers, 50 caliber machine guns. You know, this is the type of artillery that they had and that they were setting up. I mean, they came out there to kill. That's the bottom line. They didn't come out there to arrest. Wilson Good himself stated...
He was the mayor at the time.
He was the mayor, first black mayor of Philadelphia, stated that he wanted a permanent end to Move. When their 10,000 rounds of bullets did not kill us, the water hoses, the tear gas did not do the job that they wanted it to do, they concocted a bomb made of a powerful military explosive, C4, and got a state police helicopter, and they got the C4 from the federal government, from the FBI. So if you want to talk about a conspiracy, local, state, and federal government, the state police helicopter flew over our home without any warning, and two bomb squad, Philadelphia bomb squad police officers, dropped that bomb on the roof of our home. It ignited a fire that the fire commissioner was appraised of immediately, and they made a decision, a conscious decision, not to put the fire out.
You know, Ramona, this is Michael Ratner.
Right.
It's 28 years later, and I remember when it happened, and it's still completely beyond. It's the most one of the most shocking stories I know in America, that they bombed your house. I mean, it's incredible. In the middle of Philadelphia, I mean, it's still 28 years later, and we're coming up on Mother's Day. Just utterly shocking.
Ramona, there's a film that just came out called Let the Fire Burn. It premiered here in New York at the Tribeca Film Festival. It has a lot of raw footage from the time that all of this happened, including excerpts from the commission that was convened that found there was blame on the part of the local officials, although no one was ever charged with anything. But one of the parts of the film that I will never forget is when they interview Birdie Africa, who you were the two surviving people from the bombing. Birdie describes the sound of the automatic fire, and he sort of taps out quickly.
Yes.
Then they contrast it with a police officer saying it was regular fire, and he taps it out very slowly. But when you both exited the rear of that building, one thing that I'm not sure people are aware of, but that you've stated over the years, is that there were police with weapons aimed at you so that anyone who wanted to escape that building, had they run out, would probably have turned back into the fire because they knew they would be shot.
Absolutely. In fact, I was shot back into the building. You know, because of the gunfire, I was forced back into the building several times before I actually got out. And the only way I did get out, and don't ask me to explain how, I did not get shot down because, as Birdie, you know, demonstrated, they were shooting all around us, you know. As we came out, you could hear the gunshots hitting the building all around us. But the reason that Birdie and I got out was that we were faced with a situation where either you're going to get burned alive for certain, or you possibly get shot to death. That's what was facing us. And I was able to get out, and Birdie was right behind me, and I was able to pull him out. And we are the only two that survived. And it is truly miraculous. We both have severe burn scars on us that we carry to this day. But it is truly miraculous that we survived.
And thank God you did. I have two questions. One is, when you walk down the streets of Philadelphia, do the police know who you are?
Yeah, they know who I am.
Do the neighbors support you? Do you have support in that city?
I have a lot of support in this city. I mean, I can't walk down the street or go in a store or anything like that without people saying, "Oh, you're Ramona, God bless you." Or if they're not quite sure, say, What's your name? And if I say Ramona, "I knew it. God bless you, sister." I mean, you know, that's the kind of response that we get. And one thing I always explain is that MOVE is not under any illusions about the kind of support we have. We're not hallucinating about the feelings of people in the city of Philadelphia. The only thing that is happening is that those feelings that people have to be turned into action. The feelings are not enough.
Ramona, why were you arrested? You did 7 years in prison?
Yes.
On a riot charge?
I had a laundry list of charges against me, including the charges in the warrants that the police came out there with on Sunday, May 12th. People should understand that those charges, all of those charges that stemmed from April 29th, 2 weeks before May 11th, that they treated as an emergency, went to the emergency judge, Lynn Abraham, to get warrants for, they were all dropped. Every single one of those charges were dropped, meaning they had no valid reason to be out there. But anyway,
so even though those charges were dropped, you were convicted on some of those charges.
On charges from what happened on May 13th itself. I was charged with everything that the police did. Arson, possession of explosives, recklessly endangering the lives of others, simple and aggravated assault, conspiracy. I mean, everything they did, they charged me with. And finally, I was acquitted of all charges except I was convicted of conspiracy. No, riot, I'm sorry, because conspiracy is, it comes under riot. So I was convicted of riot and sentenced to 7 years in prison, 16 months to 7 years. And when my 16-month minimum was up, I saw the parole board, and they indicated that they were willing to parole me, but only if I severed all ties with my MOVE family, and agreed to have absolutely no contact with any MOVE member. I would not agree to that, so I ended up doing the 7 years. Right now, the MOVE 9 have seen the parole board four times. They became eligible for parole in 2008. And every time they see the parole board denies them, saying that they won't take responsibility, you know, for the crimes on August 8th, even though my family has told them for close to 35 years now that they're not guilty of the death of James Ramp or any other crimes on that day. But because they won't lie and say they're guilty, the parole board continues to deny them. We're doing a program on Saturday, May 11th, to commemorate what happened. It's an open mic program. A rapper named Immortal Technique out of New York is hosting it. And there is just a lineup that's going to be unbelievable. And we encourage people to come on out to the program. New York is not that far. If people want more information about MOVE or about the program, they can contact me at 215-386-1165 or by email at onamovellja@gmail.com.
Ramona, this story will, I think, go down in textbooks as probably the most political case of this country in recent years. And we look forward to talking to you later, perhaps more about the MOVE 9 and their status. But on this anniversary, we thank you so much for being with us and applaud your principled stand over the years.
Well, I appreciate that, and thank you for keeping the information out there. And what I would like to leave people with is that the MOVE 9, Mumia Abu-Jamal, Russell Maroon Schultz, Dr. Matulu Shakur, all of these political prisoners, their fate is not in the hands of the courts or these parole boards. They are in our hands, the hands of the people. And it is our responsibility, our obligation to stand up for them and to stand against the injustices that they are faced with.
Ramona Africa, you have our immense support and solidarity, and we thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder.
I appreciate it.
Really
that.
Appreciate
thank
it.
Thank you very much. On
thank
a
you.
MOVE and long live revolution.
On a MOVE.
On a MOVE.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. Thank you.
Last week, the FBI placed 65-year-old grandmother Assata Shakur on its most wanted terrorist list, while the state of New Jersey raised the bounty on her head to $2 million. This was done, conveniently, right after the Boston bombing and falls on the 40th anniversary of the 1973 shootout in which the New Jersey state troopers allege that Assata killed a trooper during a traffic stop on the New Jersey Turnpike. Assata is also known as Joanne Chesimard. She's an African-American activist and had been a member of the Black Panther Party and the Black Liberation Army. She was a victim of the FBI's COINTELPRO program, which sought to destroy the Black Panther Party. She was eventually imprisoned, then liberated, and sought and received political asylum in Cuba in 1984. We talk today with Eugene Puryear about his recent article in Liberation titled Assata Shakur, Understanding the Politics Behind the FBI's New Attack. Eugene is a writer and on the editorial board of Liberation. Eugene, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much for having me.
Eugene, you wrote a very good article about Assata Shakur in Liberation, the newspaper. And I wanted to ask you initially, why are they putting a 65-year-old grandmother, the first woman, on a terrorist list? She's in asylum in Cuba, and all of a sudden they've put this woman on a terrorist list. Can you explain the background, why you think this is happening?
Of course. Well, I think what's really happening here, why a 65-year-old grandmother has been put on the most wanted terrorist list, it's a reflection of the United States government's fear of that which opposes it. And certainly Assata Shakur, who was a part of sort of the broad movements that happened in the 60s and the early 70s, of course the Black Panther Party, the anti-Vietnam War movement, and many other things. This was a movement that the U.S. government, the Nixon administration, attempted to criminalize, to say that political dissent and political opposition to the U.S. government and its imperial moves around the world was in fact not a legitimate response to what they were doing, but was a criminal act. And so even though Assata Shakur doesn't fit the profile of what they've been calling a terrorist in the past 10 years, she does fit the profile of what the United States government has been trying to perpetuate for 30 years, and in a sense, an extension of COINTELPRO, which is that those who oppose the United States' actions and those who view the issue of political violence in a way different than the United States are criminals and not, you know, freedom fighters. It's sort of that old quote, one person's terrorist, another person's freedom fighter. I would say to the oppressed masses of the world, Assata Shakur, her actions and her beliefs are certainly not something that is beyond the pale, but to the United States government, because of its view, its positive view of its own actions, they view her as a terrorist. And so by placing her on this list, it's a way to criminalize dissent and to send a message that, in fact, the United States still is opposed to anyone who attempts to challenge its imperial writ.
Eugene, as attorneys, one of the things that we see time and time again in political cases is that the rule of law somehow doesn't seem to apply in courtrooms when there's an individual who, as you say, criticizes the U.S. government. And in Assata's case, for example, a murder conviction came despite clear medical and forensic evidence showing that Assata was shot with her hands in the air. In a court of law, they said she was physically unable to fire a weapon. And despite a witness recanting testimony that fingered her as a shooter. What do you say of that?
Well, I think that's it's 100% correct, and I think when we look even what they did with the trial, I mean, the trial was moved several times. It was placed in counties that were mostly wealthy, mostly white, where pre-trial publicity around the case had biased people in a major way against Assata Shakur. And since there was no evidence, I mean, it's a very great point you make here. I mean, obviously a surgeon that examined her said it was not possible for her to have actually shot or done what this officer who changed his testimony several times said it was possible. So without any actual physical evidence, anything linking her to a gun, in fact, a gunshot residue test showed that she had not fired a gun recently, they had to play on the fears. They had to play on the fears of people in these counties who were, you know, by and large more affluent, certainly mostly white, and play on their fears both of blacks, of radicals, and of course black radicals. And so I think that this is a clear example of how in these political trials, when the government wants to put someone away and they know they don't have the evidence, they do everything possible to manipulate both the venue and also bring in people whose predispositions will make them more likely to believe the government's version of events.
Yeah, that's certainly true, Eugene. I'm thinking now of the Cuban Five, what they did to them. But with Asada, they had an all-white jury, didn't they?
Mm-hmm. Yes, they did.
And they had people that were related to or knew the dead police officer as well. It's incredible that they allowed that jury to stand. But Len, let's take the story forward. Once she's convicted, then she's imprisoned. Talk to us about the conditions of her imprisonment and finally her liberation. And then let's get to Cuba.
Certainly. Well, the conditions of her imprisonment were quite harsh, I mean, as they often are. I mean, political prisoners in this country are routinely subjected to solitary confinement, to abuse from guards, to the prison officials attempting to stimulate hatred against them. And so Asada was in a position where she was going to be put in prison for the rest of her life in these sorts of human-breaking conditions. That's what they really are. These
life plus 33 years they gave her.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And how long was she in solitary confinement?
You know, I'm not sure how exactly it was, but she was moved around frequently. Her conditions were constantly changing, and sort of that's another facet of political prisoners, is that oftentimes they try to throw you off balance to change things as much as they can to keep you from developing a routine. And so it created a situation where it was not tenable for her to remain inside of prison walls. And through methods that, you know, obviously we don't know, some of her comrades were able to free her. And then after several years of being political exile, most likely in America, she was able to make it to Cuba.
And Michael, let me bring you into this discussion. Political asylum, that's something that's recognized under international law, isn't it?
Well, you know, I look at this issue a lot because, of course, Julian Assange is been given political asylum in the Embassy of Ecuador in London. And so we looked into what the rules are about it. And the main rule is, once someone's been given political asylum, other governments can't go against it. They can't question it. They're not allowed to do that. And they can't take actions that are contrary to the granting of political asylum. It's a pretty clear rule. And here what you see now clearly, openly, is a person who's been granted political asylum by Cuba is being utterly undercut by the United States, has been for years. The latest, of course, is this putting Asada on the terrorist list and the billboards. All completely, utterly illegal.
Article 14 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights provides that, quote, everyone has the right to seek and to enjoy in other countries asylum from persecution.
Right, and there's rulings that say, and you can't do anything that cuts against that grant of political asylum.
So, Eugene, here's the $64 question. Why now? She's been in Cuba for many decades. People haven't seen her in the news for many decades. And all of a sudden, after the Boston bombing, you have that billboard in New Jersey, the hiking up ransom, what, to
$2 million.
Dollars. What's going on? Why do you think that this is being done? It was done with the complicity of the FBI, that is the Department of Justice, that is the Attorney General Holder, as well as the New Jersey troopers. Why is this being done now?
Well, I think there's twofold reasoning behind it. I mean, I think one thing we must pay attention to is the day before this happened, the United States government refused to remove Cuba from the state sponsors of terrorism list. So obviously this is being used at least in part as a justification for keeping Cuba on that list, which will make it significantly harder for there to be any sort of normalization, not even normalization, regularization of any sort of ties between Cuba and the United States. It sort of gums up the works and it makes it easier for the United States to maintain this blockade and to maintain essentially this fiction that Cuba is around the world supporting terrorism against the United States, when in fact it's the United States that allows people to walk around in Miami and other places in this country completely free when they've admitted to committing terrorist acts against Cuba. So I think that's certainly one element of it, is the attempt to maintain this criminal blockade on Cuba, which is another attempt really to criminalize dissent from the U.S. Global agenda. And I think secondly, to give a chilling effect on progressive movements here in the United States. I mean, we've seen, you mentioned the Boston case, and we sort of are seeing how significantly, and especially around the torture memos with the drones, the United States seems to be redefining what it considers to be terrorist action and what its responses are. I mean, I remember when the U.S. attorney was speaking about Asada Shakur's case, he mentioned that she was, quote-unquote, making speeches that espoused terrorist ideology, quote, terrorist ideology, which means that making speeches in support of something that the United States government considers terrorism can be construed as terrorism. Now, obviously, there's different legal things that go on with this, but I think it's a very important thing starting to look at this. I mean, the lockdown of Boston, the reclassification of Assata Shakur, the issue in the drone memo of what imminence actually means, is all of these, and all of these rulings, the United States, I think, is creating, at least attempting to create enough ambiguity in these different statutes to show, okay, well, if you stand up for Assata Shakur or other political prisoners who may or may not have been affiliated with the Black Liberation Army, or if you stand up against our policies, you know, this could happen to you. You could be criminalized. You could go to Guantanamo. I mean, all these different things, which has a major chilling effect on popular movements, which I think the United States government is very scared about, because it continues to perpetuate the conditions that give rise to these movements.
You know, Eugene, what you've said is actually right, I think, and it's terrifying when you look at the lockdown in Boston, the recharacterization of Assata as, quote, a terrorist, and then you take it to them saying, well, you know, she's preaching things, preaching is not the right word, saying things about, you know, the United States and all of that, and then you go to the drone killing of al-Awlaki in Yemen, who is the Muslim cleric who also, not also, but who is preaching very militantly against the United States, and they droned him to death. So it goes from Boston to putting her on a billboard to droning, and as you said, they've lowered the standard for when they could kill people overseas, and you don't know with these guys. And of course, the dangers for Assata, and with that kind of reward on her head and calling her a terrorist, with 600,000 people from Miami visiting the island every year, is you don't know what's going to happen. You don't know what people are going to do, and it's really frightening.
Yes, no, I agree with that 100%. I mean, I think certainly, you know, we're in a situation where people really need to stand up, because these are not small changes, even though they're sort of can be presented as that. It just seems like a slight of word here and there. But I think certainly it's a situation where if we don't stand up and speak very loudly about these issues of civil liberties, we could find our rights to dissent to be seriously hampered.
Eugene, are you aware of any moves that are being taken in solidarity with Assata?
Yes, well, you know, it's actually been really interesting. I mean, one thing is just watching social media has been quite interesting to see, like, the memes that have been popping up and people expressing support on different statements. I mean, it actually showed, I think, that there's still a significantly, especially because of the impact of her memoirs or autobiography, a significant section of support of people, especially young people, young Black women, and young women of color who are actively coming out on these social networking sites and supporting Assata Shakur and challenging this definition of her being a terrorist. I've seen several articles have been written. I know in New York City, in front of City Hall a few days ago, I believe it was Charles Barron and some others who came out and held some signs in support of Assata Shakur. So we're seeing really the grassroots starting to bubble up in almost a spontaneous way in a reaction to this move, which I think is actually quite encouraging, that without any real preparation, individuals who may not have even been political are starting to, even if it's just in social media, that's a very public venue, are starting to come out and publicly stake a claim, not only in support of Assata, but also, you know, opposed to what's happening and how these terrorism laws are being used.
Eugene, we actually just spoke with Ramona Africa about the MOVE bombing, and she ended her segment on a really, I think, inspiring and true statement, that is, we can't rely on the U.S. Courts for relief in political cases, obviously, but really these kind of incidents impress on us the importance of the power of a people's movement. And I think you've just shown to us that the response has been so highly positive in favor of Assata.
Thank you very much for your incisive reporting in Liberation Newspaper, and thanks for being on Law and Disorder.
No, thank you guys so much.
Really important work, Eugene. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Last year, a coalition of Immokalee workers won the struggle against Trader Joe's, which finally signed the Fair Food Agreement and agreed to pay the penny a pound more for tomatoes to farm workers in Florida. Since then, CIW's efforts have focused on public supermarkets in the Southeast and Wendy's fast food chain. Recently, fair food activists across the country visited their local Wendy's to deliver a message. It's time to join the rest of the fast food industry and support the fair food program. Today we're joined by two people from Florida and the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, Emilio Faustino and Joe Parker, to talk about the fair food and CW actions in New York City. Welcome to Law and Disorder. The first question is, what is the CIW and what is its campaign?
Nosotros somos yo de Immokalee. somos trabajadores de la coalición de trabajadores. Es a donde, en esa comunidad, existen los abusos. Muchos abusos, tanto los bajos salarios, robo de salarios, agresiones verbales, físicas y el acoso sexual.
We're farm workers who come from the town of Immokalee, Florida, that's based in the southwestern part of the state, and we're farm workers. Our community is a community of farm workers, and for many years, we've faced a number of different kinds of exploitation, poverty, wage theft, physical and verbal abuse, as well as sexual harassment for many women working in the fields.
I know you've won a number of your campaigns for higher wages and ending abuse in the fields. 11 companies already have signed the Fair Food Agreement with you. Tell us about that a little bit, but tell us why you're in New York now.
Así es. Esto empezó cuando empezamos nuestras campañas, nuestras protestas en contra de las corporaciones. Cuando iniciamos es por ver para los derechos de los trabajadores. En eso empezamos con primero con Taco Bell, McDonald's, Burger King, Subway y todos los demás corporaciones. Actualmente son 11.
Yes, that's exactly right. We began our campaign focused on the big corporate buyers of the produce that we pick back in 2001 in an effort to improve wages and working conditions in the fields. We began with Taco Bell and from there had campaigns with McDonald's, Burger King, until, as you said, 11 other companies came to the table to dialogue with farm workers and work toward improving those wages and working conditions in their supply chains.
El motivo, estamos aquí en Nueva York, son las razones que tenemos en contra de Wendy's. El por qué, él lleva por baño, llevamos por varios años que venimos enfocándonos con él, pidiéndole también los mismos derechos de que, porque otras, las corporaciones mencioné primero, han firmado, entonces él nos ha ignorado.
We're here in New York focused on Wendy's fast food chain. For a number of years, the coalition has been sending letters to Wendy's asking them to join the Fair Food Program. We launched a public campaign with them earlier this year, but thus far they have ignored us and refused to be a part of the program.
How has your support been among other food-related groups, grassroots organizations in New York?
Lo que otras organizaciones, como siempre, tenemos estos aliados y gracias a eso también hemos llevado estas ventajas de nuestra lucha. Esta lucha se ha iniciado y no pararemos, pero gracias también a gente que nos vienen apoyando y aquí en la ciudad de Nueva York tenemos esos grandes apoyos para darle frente con Wendy's.
The support among these groups has been enormous and extremely strong, and it's been due to their support throughout the years that we've been able to achieve the victories that we've won thus far, and even speaking more generally to ally support throughout the history of the campaign, it's been a crucial component to the work that we've done.
What do we want Wendy's to do?
Lo que queremos de Wendy's, haga lo mismo que las otras 11 corporaciones que ya lo han hecho. Él por igual le pedimos que firme que lo que pedimos nosotros, que los otros hicieron, es lo que pedimos el sueldo, el aumento.
We want Wendy's to do the exact same thing that these 11 other corporations have done. That's first to pay one penny more for every pound of tomatoes that they buy to help support a living wage for farm workers in the fields, and also to only buy from farms that are respecting farm workers' rights. And this is really interesting to us that they've continued to turn their back so far on farm workers who are asking them to participate. Even Emil Brolik, who's the current president of Wendy's, was the president of Taco Bell when Taco Bell signed the agreement. And at that time, he actually said in a public statement that this wasn't something Taco Bell could do alone and that they needed the support of other industry leaders in order to make this work.
What are your plans in New York for protesting Wendy's and your plans outside of New York as well?
Estamos aquí es para hacer esta acción o esta protesta en contra de Wendy's. Es para también la junta con los accionistas. De antemano sabemos quiénes son los accionistas que existen. Eso es lo que nosotros queremos, a que nos tomen en cuenta para estas necesidades, y son necesidades de un trabajo que merece el trabajador de la agricultura de la Florida. Para esto, vamos a hacer esta acción, o vuelvo a repetir, protesta, que va a ser el sábado 18 de mayo a las 2 de la tarde, aquí en la Union Square.
We're here for the Wendy's shareholder action. We're going to be organizing a protest on Saturday, May 18th at 2 p.m. in Union Square to send a message to the company's investors that this is something that farm workers in Wendy's supply chain really deserve, and that they need to be participating in the Fair Food Program. There will also be a number of actions taking place that weekend all across the country in a number of communities that are standing together with the CIW.
If people want information on how they can protest in other cities and New York, where can they go? How do they find the information?
Bueno, a esto estamos siempre para, estamos en decir en comunicación que estamos con ellos, siempre tratamos de nuestro email a estar en comunicación para ellos saber a dónde estamos, qué estamos y cuándo, qué es lo que vamos a hacer. Eso se ha hecho para todos los, en todos los estados. Hemos hecho, por ejemplo, las visitas, presentaciones, esas invitaciones. Bien.
We're doing all that we can here to get the word out, presentations and meetings with different allies, but if anyone around the country would like to participate, who or anyone who's not here in the city of New York, you can definitely get in contact with us via our website, ciw-online.org, or send us an email, workers@ciw-online.org, or call the office directly, and that number is 239-657-8311.
Say the number once more.
239-657-8311.
Is there anything else you want to tell people?
De mi parte, claro que sí. Mire, lo que es hacer, estoy haciendo esta invitación para que nos den este apoyo, ya que este apoyo, pues, gracias, vuelvo a repetir, y que a la gente que nos ha apoyado y a la verdad se ha hecho algo en los cambios, y queremos más cambios para que se establezca todos esos derechos para la comunidad de la agricultura.
I simply want to extend the invitation to everyone once more on behalf of the CIW to join us. And I want to repeat once more that it's been due to the support of allies like all of you over the years that we've been able to achieve these victories and are starting to see concrete changes taking place in the fields. And we want to keep those changes growing, keep them expanding, so that everyone in the farmworker community can live and work with dignity and respect.
Emilio and Joe, thank you very much. And we expect another victory.
Thank you so much.
Gracias.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.